Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we're talking about book... Why do I always do that? Why do I always do that? We're talking about the book, The Enormous Room, Chapter 11, Part 2. Chapter 11, Part 2. But I just wanted to make a little announcement. Techrific has gone ahead, moderator extraordinaire, and created flares in anticipation for our next book, Anna Karenina. So you can now, if you participate in the subreddit, create yourself a flare to let us all know which translation of the book you are reading. They do that over at the Year of War and Peace subreddit. There's instructions, I think, included. He's made a post in today's in the subreddit, so go check that out if you want to add your flair. And by the way, you probably all know this by now, but our next book is, of course, Anna Karenina. So go ahead and get your copy of that. Now, what was I going to say? Oh yeah, so I've been you know, when we started this project, I wanted to publish my way through the list. And that was actually a dream of mine to do that for a very long time. And we put out the first three, and then Amazon decided that they didn't want us to have them up anymore, even though they already approved them. They went back on that approval and made us take them down after publishing three of them. Well, six of them, actually, because it was three books, but... it was ebook and paperback, so there was actually six publications. And one of those publications had two of the books in it, so in a way it was four stories. They made us take it all down, which is really frustrating because they approved it, and then they went back on their approval. Then I tried for the fourth book we read, or the fifth, I suppose you could say, but it was the fourth book that I wanted to publish. That was Wuthering Heights? No, that was... Oh, it was The Brothers Karamazov. I published that through a different printing place, a different print-on-demand supplier, and it just seemed like no one really wanted to make the switch. Like, a lot of people were buying the books as we progressed through them, and then with this one, didn't really happen. And that's fine. I think Amazon is a very trusted retailer, and then to switch from that to just buying it on like a website, a normal website, yeah. And then so for the current book, I decided to try to get around Amazon's demands. They said if we put in 10 illustrations into the book, then it would pass their approval. So I drew 10 pictures to go into the book, not to add any value to the book, like, and if anything, they make the book worse because they're bad pictures, but just so I was able to publish it, I had to draw 10 pictures and include it. But then no one really, I don't think anyone purchased it, which is, again, like, fine. I'm not saying, like, I needed you guys to purchase it, but, like, if no one's interested, like, I did it as a little value add to sort of cover the effort that I put into the podcast and into the community. So I don't know if people aren't really interested to buy them anymore, and I'm having to jump through all these hoops to publish them, it's become sort of more effort than it's worth in a way, which is really disappointing because I would have loved to have a matching box set of the Hemingway books called the Hemingway List. But yeah, I think I'm going to drop that idea from here on, because it's just getting too difficult, you know? So 100% you can blame Amazon for that. I usually don't like to sort of bite the hand that feeds me, but the fact that they approved it all and then unapproved it and then sort of tried to tell me that I'd broken their terms of service or something like that, and they kind of demanded that I take them all down immediately. It really, really frustrated me because it was like, well, like, the reason there's an approval process is so that I can make sure that I'm complying to what you approve of. And they did approve of them. And if they didn't approve of them straight up, like before I went ahead and started publishing them, that would have been fine. But the fact that I was like, you know, four titles into the project when they suddenly changed their tune, I was like, well, that was a lot of work that now I have to, like, I don't want to discontinue it because we've already started. And I don't know. It just put me in a tricky spot where I was like, well, I wish you had have just disapproved of it at the start and that would have been fine. But yeah, midway through a project, it's just a really frustrating thing to do to someone. And yeah, so they made it too difficult, basically. They made it too difficult to do. So I don't mind kind of biting the hand that feeds me in that respect, because I think that's a really disrespectful thing to do to someone. I think it's a really inconsiderate thing to do to, you know, they're a bookseller, I'm a publisher. I think they should try to build good relationships, but they're just so big that they don't care. So they just treat people not like people, essentially. They don't treat me as a person. They just pull the rug out from under me. I don't know. It really, really bothered me, to be honest, because the thing that always, this is just a personal thing, that I hate when a corporation does business with you as if you're not like a person, sort of thing. Like, it's really impersonal. That always frustrates me. So I don't know. It just really bothered me. So it's just, yeah. Yeah, I'm not happy with them. And I'm really disappointed that I'm having to end that part of this project, is to have the matching box set of books. It's really, like, maybe one day in the future I'll publish them through a different medium or something, but yeah, I don't know. They made it very difficult. It doesn't matter. There'll be plenty of other awesome publications in the future that you guys can get or not get if you wish. But yeah, so for now, what we're going to have to do is just get our own versions of the books. So you have to source a copy of Anna Karenina. And the big conversation now among the community is which translation to read, because there's quite a few translations. PNV is very good. PNV is very trusted, very easy to read. So I would always recommend a PNV translation. If you want the public domain version, definitely go with Maud. Maud is brilliant. Maud's translation of War and Peace, different Tolstoy book, but still, got Tolstoy's approval. It was the only English translation that he approved of, during his lifetime, because it was written, it was translated that long ago. But back then, there was a few different translations of War and Peace into English, and they were all a bit shoddy. And then Maud was, it's really brilliant. And that's the one I read. I read the Maud translation of War and Peace, and it was really good. There was nothing, it was just good. It was just good, plain, clean, easy to understand writing, and very faithful recreation of Tolstoy's nuance in the way he writes. So I would almost recommend the Maud as much as the PNV, especially the point that PNV is a copyrighted one, so you have to purchase it, whereas Maud is in the public domain, so you can read the whole Maud translation of Anna Karenina for free online. Now, as I say that, I'm only 90% sure that there is a Maud translation of Anna Karenina. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. I'll just make sure it's also online. What's the website that you use? Project Gutenberg, sorry. Okay, so we've got Gutenberg. I'm sorry, I'm just double checking this. This is very bad podcasting. Translated by Garnet. Nah, get that out of here. Get that out of here. I'm not reading another Garnet book. Wait, was it Garnet that did that last one reread? That really bad one? Anna Karenina Maud, full translation. Maybe it's not in the public domain. Oh my gosh. Alright, I should do this research on another day. Okay, back to the show. I'm sorry. A lot of umming and ahhing. You guys are probably bored out of your brains. Should do this research before I go on the air. Anyway, I Am Norwegian said, oh yeah, by the way, the questions I asked is, what do you think was Jean's fate? This is regarding the enormous room. And what was the most memorable part of this chapter for you? This chapter felt very different from the rest and redeemed Cummings a bit in my eyes. For once, he didn't write with apathy. He cared about the injustice done to Jean, and it showed in the writing. It also helps that Jean is a very funny character. We start the penultimate chapter. Today we start the penultimate chapter. Very exciting stuff. Techrific said, well said. I have not cared for this book at all so far. Just want it over and done with. I can't wait for Tolstoy. I'm trying two translations, Maud and Bartlett. The bar is high, coming as I do from War and Peace, the Pavia version. I love that translation. I Am Norwegian says, I oscillate between ugh and hey, this is kind of fun. I am looking forward to Tolstoy, though. I have to start checking out what translation I read. Oh, God. We just got off the topic of the translations, and now I'm getting back into it. I have the PNV translation of Notes from Underground. Maybe I should check it out, see if I enjoy their translation, if they have one of Anna Karenina. Techrific said they do have one, but I haven't heard good things about it, unfortunately. That's why I decided on Bartlett. Bartlett is also considered more faithful to the Russian original. I'm hoping that's a good thing, considering it's Tolstoy. I'm not so sure I'd say that about a Dostoevsky novel, since the original Russian is awkward, as Garnett made it sound, apparently. Anyhoots, it'd be fun to compare different versions. Maybe we should do different versions of Flair, as we did for War and Peace. It could be interesting to know which version people are reading. Hey, I look like I'm right now reading the origin conversation behind that post that Techrific made about the Flares. Yeah, that's what I've heard about PNV, says I Am Norwegian. Some people hate their translations, but mostly people think they are the best ones out there. I'll have to Google it a bit. Flares is a good idea. The first comment I found, says I Am Norwegian, is whatever you do, stay as far away from the Garnett. That is my go-to text for an example of how a particular translation can ruin a novel. Haha, poor Ander. Techrific said, poor Ander, can't he go for the Maud version? It should be in the public domain. I Am Norwegian said, I have no idea, but I hope so. Oh, I really want to know now. Okay, let me do a quick version. The quick public domain versions of Anna Karenina. Karenina. And I'm also going to say Anna Karenina Maud translation. Let me just make sure that exists. Translated by Louise and Aylmer Maud in 1918. Almost all of the other English language editions of Anna Karenina use the faulty, unrevised translation by Constant Garnett, and some do not even name Garnett as the translator. The Maud translation is also used in notable print editions, including Oxford World Classics and Everyman Library editions. None of the early translations of Anna Karenina are acceptable, including the unrevised Garnett. The appearance of the Maud version in 1918 represents a turning point. Louise and Alma Maud knew Tolstoy's pre-revolutionary Russia. She was born and educated there. She spent many years in Moscow. They knew Tolstoy personally and had the benefit of consultation with him and his approval of their translations. Okay. 1918 would mean that it falls within the public domain, so you should be able to get a copy of that for free. That's my understanding. I could be wrong. I can't seem to find it. Oh, wait. Nope, that's Garnet again. All right. You should be able to read the Maud one if it's 1918. Because my understanding is anything before 1923. I might be wrong, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to risk it. I'm going to read... Oh, my God. Did you hear that? What? That is the biggest blowfly I've ever seen in my life. Sorry, I just got harassed by what appears to be a small dragon flying around my study. What are you doing, fly? It's bloody 1 a.m. Go to bed. Go to fly bed. All right, you'll have to excuse me while I get some fly spray and kill this little guy. Fun little excursion. I killed the hell out of that guy. Where were we? Oh yeah, I'm going to read the Maud one, even if it's not in the public domain, because I'm pretty sure it should be. If it's not, it should be. And I don't think I'm going to get sued by anyone. Yeah. I'll track it down. Anyway, The Enormous Room. Let's read The Enormous Room. We're nearly finished. Two chapters to go. I am still going to break them up into halves because they're quite long. Let me just check here. 2, 5, 8, 11, 14, 17, maths, 18. Okay, I'm going to do a half chapter today. Half chapter. Chapter 12 is called Three Wise Men, and it goes a little bit like this. It must have been late in November when La Commission arrived. La Commission, as I have said, visited La Ferté every 3 months. That is to say, B and I, by arriving when we did, had just escaped its clutches. I consider this one of the luckiest things in my life. La Commission arrived one morning and began work immediately. A list was made of La Hommes who were to pass La Commission, another of La Femmes. These lists were given to the planton with the wooden hand. In order to avert any delay, those of the men whose names fell in the first half of the list were not allowed to enjoy the usual stimulating activities afforded by La Ferté's supreme environment. They were, in fact, confined to The Enormous Room, subject to instant call. Moreover, they were not called one by one, or as their respective turns came, but in groups of three or four. The idea being that La Commission should suffer no smallest annoyance which might be occasioned by loss of time. There were always, in other words, 8 or 10 men waiting in the upper corridor opposite a disagreeably crisp door. Which door belonged to that mysterious room wherein La Commission transacted its inestimable affairs. No more than a couple of yards away, 10 or 8 women waited their turns. Conversation between the men and... Oh man, 10 or 8 women. 10 or 8. I don't know why that bothers me so much, but... 10 or 8. Who names the bigger number first? Who does that? Come on, man. I feel like I've got like that OCD feeling. Not more than a couple of yards away, 10 or 8 women waited their turns. That's so unsatisfying to read. 10 or 8 women waited their turns. Oh, makes me, that's like cringy. Oh, that's probably a personal thing. But does that bother anyone else? I'd love to know. Not more than a couple of yards away, 10 or 8 women waited their turns. Conversation between the men and the women had been forbidden in the fiercest terms by Monsieur le Directeur. Nevertheless, conversation spasmodically occurred, thanks to the indulgent nature of the wooden hand. The wooden hand must have been cuckoo, he looked it. If he wasn't, I am totally at a loss to account for his indulgence. B and I spent a morning in The Enormous Room without results, an astonishing acquisition of nervousness, expected, accepted. Après le soupe, noon, we were conducted, en haute, told to leave our spoons and bread, which we did, and in company with several others, whose names were within a furlong of the last man called, were descended to the corridor. All that afternoon we waited. Also we waited all the next morning. We spent our time talking quietly with a buxom, pink-cheeked Belgian girl who was in attendance as translator for one Les Femmes. This Belgian told us that she was a permanent inhabitant of La Ferté, that she had another femme hornet occupied a room by themselves, that her brothers were at the front of Belgium, that her ability to speak fluently several languages, including English and German, made her invaluable to Messieurs Le Commission, that she had committed no crime, that she was held as a suspect, that she was not entirely unhappy. She struck me immediately as being not only intelligent but alive. She questioned us in excellent English as to our offences, and seemed much pleased to discover that we were, to all appearances, innocent of wrongdoing. From time to time, our subdued conversation was interrupted by admonitions from the amiable wooden hand. Twice the door slammed open, the Monsieur le Directeur bounced out, frothing at the mouth and threatening everyone with infinite cabinot, on the ground that everyone's deportment, or lack of it, was menacing the aplomb of the commissioners. Each time the black holster appeared in the background and carried on his master's bullying until everyone was completely terrified, after which we were left to ourselves and the wooden hand once again. B and I were allowed by the latter individual, he was that day at least an individual, not merely a planton, to peek over his shoulder at the men's list. The wooden hand even went so far as to escort our editious minds to the nearest of their examination by the simple yet efficient method of placing one of his human fingers opposite the name of him who was, even at that moment, within submitting to the inexorable justice of le gouvernement français. I cannot honestly say that the discovery of this proximity of ourselves to our respective fates wholly pleased us, yet we were so weary of waiting that it certainly did not wholly terrify us. All in all, I think I have never been so utterly at ease as while waiting for the axe to fall, metaphorically speaking, upon our squawking heads. We were still conversing with the Belgian girl when a man came out of the door unsteadily, looking as if he had submitted to several strenuous fittings of a wooden leg upon a stump not quite healed. The wooden hand, nodding at B, remarked hurriedly in a low voice, "Allez." And B, smiling at Le Belge and at me, entered. He was followed by the wooden hand, as I suppose for greater security. The next 20 minutes, or whatever it was, were by far the most nerve-wracking which I had as yet experienced. Le Belge said to me, "Il est gentil votre ami," and I agreed, and my blood was bombarding the roots of my toes and the summits of my hair. After, I need not say, 2 or 3 million eons, B emerged. I had not time to exchange a look with him, let alone a word, for the wooden hand said from the doorway, "Allez l'être américain," and I entered in more confusion than can easily be imagined. Entered the torture chamber, entered the Inquisition, entered the tentacles of that sly and beaming polyp de le gouvernement français. As I entered, I said half aloud, "The thing is this, to look 'em in the eyes and keep cool whatever happens, not for the fraction of a moment forgetting that they are made of Murdy, that they are all of them composed entirely of Murdy. I don't know how many inquisitors I expected to see, but I guess I was ready for at least 15, among them President Poincaré, Louis Memmi." I hummed noiselessly, "Si vous passez par ma ville, n'oubliez pas ma maison, on y mange de bonne soupe, tonton tani, faked de murdy, et list onions, tonton tani, tonton ton." Remembering the fine Fourgeron of Chavancourt, who used to sing this, or something very like it, upon a table entirely for the benefit of les deux Americains, who would subsequently render its au longi way to tea pire rarely re, wholly for the gratification of a room full of what Mr. Anderson liked to call them bastards, alias dirty Frenchmen, alias Le Poilus, Les Poilus Divinis. A little room, the director's office, or the surveillance. Comfort, oh yes, very, very comfortable. On my right, a table. At the table, three persons. Reminds me of Hanoi on a bit. Not unpleasantly, of course. Three persons, reading from left to right as I face them, a soggy, sleepy, slumpy lump in gendarme's cape and cap, quite old. Captain of gendarme's not at all interested, wrinkled, coarse face, only semi-merchant. Large, hard, clumsy hands floppingly disposed on table. Wily, tidy man in civilian clothes, pen in hand, obviously lawyer. Avocat type, little bald on top, squeaky civility, smells of bad perfume, or at any rate, sweetish soap. Tiny red-headed person, also civilian. Creased worryingly, excited face, amusing little body and hands, brief and jumpy, must be a Dickens character, ought to spend his time sailing kites of his own construction over other people's houses in gusty weather. Behind the three, all tied up with deference and inferiority, mild and spineless, Apollyon. Would the reader like to know what I asked? Would I could say. Only dimly do I remember those moments. Only dimly do I remember looking through the lawyer at Apollyon's clean collar. Only dimly do I remember the gradual collapse of the captain of gendarmes, his slow but sure assumption of sleepfulness, the drooping of his soggy cochon, lower and lower till it encountered one hand whose elbow, braced firmly upon the table, sustained its insensate limpness. Only dimly do I remember the enthusiastic antics of the little redhead when I spoke with patriotic fervor of the wrongs which La France was doing mon ami et moi. Only dimly do I remember to my right the immobility of the wooden hand reminding me, one, of a clothing dummy or a life-size doll which might be made to move only by him who knew the proper combination. At the outset I was asked, did I want a translator? I looked and saw the secretary, weak-eyed and lemon-pale, and I said non. I was questioned mostly by the avocat, somewhat by the Dickens, never by either the captain, who was asleep, or the director, who was timid in the presence of these great and good delegates of hope, faith, and charity per the French government. I recall that for some reason I was perfectly cool. I put over 6 or 8 hot shots without losing in the least this composure, which surprised myself and pleased myself altogether, increased myself. As the questions came for me, I met them halfway, spouting my best or worst French in a manner which positively astonished the tiny red-headed demigod. I challenged with my eyes and with my voice and with my manner Apollyon himself, and Apollyon himself merely cuddled together, depressing his hairy body between its limbs, and as a spider sometimes does in the presence of danger. I expressed immense gratitude to my captors and to Le Gouvernement Francais for allowing me to see and hear and taste and smell and touch the things which inhabited La Ferté-Macé, Orny, France. I do not think that La Commission enjoyed me much. It told me through its Swedish soap leader that my friend was a criminal, this immediately upon my entering, and I told it with a great deal of well-chosen politeness that I disagree. In telling how and why I disagreed, I think I managed to shove my shovel-shaped imagination under the refuse of their intellects, at least once or twice. Rather fatiguing to stand up and to be told, "Your friend is no good. Have you anything to say for yourself, and to say a great deal for yourself, and for your friend, and for Les Hommes, or try your best to, and be contradicted, and be told, never mind that, what we wish to know is, and instructed to keep to the subject, etc., ad infinitum." At last they asked each of us if each other wanted to ask the man before each other anything more, and each other not wanting to do so, they said, "C'est fini." As at Noyon, I had made an indisputably favourable impression upon exactly one of my three examiners. I refer in the present case to the red-headed little gentleman who was rather decent to me. I do not exactly salute him in recognition of his decency. I bow to him as I might bow to somebody who said he was sorry he couldn't give me a match. But there was a cigar store just around the corner, you know. At C'est fini, the director leaped into the limelight with a savage admonition of the wooden hand, who saluted, opened the door suddenly, and looked at me with, dare I say it, admiration. Instead of availing myself of this means of escape, I turned to the little kite-flying gentleman and said, "If you please, sir, will you be so good as to tell me what will become of my friend?" The little kite-flying gentleman did not have time to reply, for the perfumed presence stated dryly and distinctly, "We cannot say anything to you upon that point." I gave him a pleasant smile, which said, "If I could see your intestines..." Very slowly embracing a large wooden drum rotated by means of a small iron crank, turned gently and softly by myself, I should be extraordinarily happy. And I bowed softly and gently to Monsieur le Directeur, and I went through the door, using all the perpendicular inches which God had given me. Once outside, I began to tremble like a pupilla in les automnes humides et monotones. "Allez en bas pour la soupe," the wooden hand said, not unkindly. I looked about me. "There will be no more men before the commission until tomorrow," the wooden hand said. "Go get your dinner in the kitchen." I descended. Every cue was all curiosity. What did they say? What did I say? As he placed before me a huge and perfectly huge, an inexcusably huge, plate of something more than lukewarm grease, B and I ate at a very little table in the cuisine, excitedly comparing notes as we swallowed the red-hot stuff. "Dupain, Prince, Mes Amis," Africa said. "Mangez comme vous voulez," the cook quoth benignantly, with a glance at us over his placid shoulder. Eat we most surely did. We could have eaten the French government. The morning of the following day we went on a promenade once more. It was neither pleasant nor unpleasant to promenade in the corps while somebody else was suffering in the room of sorrow. It was, in fact, rather thrilling. The afternoon of this day we were all up in the enormous room when La Commission suddenly entered the Apollon, strutting and lisping behind it, explaining and poo-pooing, the graciously waving his thick, wicked arms. Everyone in the enormous room leaped to his feet, everyone removing as he did so his hat, with the exception of Les Deux Americains, who kept theirs on, and the Zulu, who couldn't find his hat, and had been trying for some time to stalk it to its lair. La Commission reacted interestingly to the enormous room. The captain of the gendarmes looked soggily around and saw nothing with a good deal of contempt. The scented soap squinted up his face and said, "Froh," or whatever a French bourgeois advocate says in the presence of a bad smell. La Commission was standing by the door and consequently close to the cabinet. But the little red-head kite-flying gentleman looked actually horrified. Is there in the room anyone of Austrian nationality?" The silent man stepped forward quietly. "Why are you here?" "I don't know," the silent man said with tears in his eyes. "Nonsense! You're here for a very good reason, and you know what it is, and you could tell if you wished. You imbecile, you incorrigible, you criminal," Apollyon shouted. Then, turning to the avocat and the red-headed little gentleman, "He is a dangerous alien. He admits it. He has admitted it. Don't you admit it, eh? He roared at the silent man, who fingered his black cap without raising his eyes or changing in the least the simple or supreme dignity of his poise. "He is incorrigible," said in a low snarl the director. "Let us go, gentlemen, when you have seen enough." But the red-headed man, as I recollect, was contemplating the floor by the door, where six pails of urine solemnly stood, three of them having overflowed slightly from time to time upon the reeking planks, and the director was told that Lehomme should have a tin trough to urinate into for the sake of sanitation, and that this trough should be immediately installed without delay. "Oh yes, indeed, sirs," Apollyon simpered. "A very good suggestion. It shall be done immediately, yes, indeed. Do let me show you the... it's just outside." And he bowed them out with no little skill. And the door slammed, in all caps letters, behind Apollyon and the three wise men. This, as I say, must have occurred towards the last of November. For a week we waited, Fritz having waited months for a letter from the Danish consul in reply to the letters which he, Fritz, wrote every so often and sent through Le Bureau, meaning the secretary, had managed to get news of his whereabouts to said consul by unlawful means. It was immediately upon reception of this news by the consul, set free and invited to join a ship at the nearest port. His departure, than which a more joyous I have never witnessed, has been already mentioned in connection with the third Delectable Mountain, as has been the departure for Prisigny of Pompom and Harry and some. Bill the Hollander, Monsieur Perez, Mexique the Wanderer, the Little Machine Fixer, Pete, Jean Le Negre, the Zulu, and Monsieur Auguste, the second time, were some of our remaining friends who passed the commission with us. Along with ourselves and these fine people were judged gentlemen like the Trick Raincoat, the Fighting Sheeny. One would think possibly that justice in the guise of the three wise men would have decreed different fates to, say, the Wanderer and the Fighting Sheeny, au contraire. As I have previously remarked, the ways of God and of the good and the French, great French government are alike inscrutable. Bill the Hollander, whom we had grown to like, whereas at first we had inclined to fear him, Bill the Hollander, who washed some towels and handkerchiefs and whatnot for us and turned them a bright pink, Bill the Hollander, who had tried so hard to teach the young Pole the lesson which he could only learn from the Fighting Sheeny, left us about a week after the commission. As I understand it, they decided to send him back to Holland under guard in order that he might be jailed in his native land as a deserter. It is beautiful to consider the unselfishness of Le Gouvernement Francais in this case, much as Le Gouvernement Francais would have liked to have punished Bill on its own account, and for its own enjoyment, it gave him up, with a Christian smile, to the punishing clutches of a sister or brother government, without a murmur denying itself the incense of his sufferings and the music of his sorrow. Then, too, it is really inspiring to note the perfect collaboration of La Justice Française and La Justice Hollandaise in a critical moment of the world's history. Bill certainly should feel that it was a great honour to be allowed to exemplify this wonderful accord, this exquisite mutual understanding between the punitive departments of two nations, superficially somewhat unrelated, that is, as regards customs and language. I fear Bill didn't appreciate the intrinsic usefulness of his destiny. I seem to remember that he left in rather gut verdurmish condition. Such is ignorance. All right, that's where we're going to finish for the day's reading. Such is ignorance. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.